We come to the first of the presentations for 2012, which is the main course. Its title is Hermetic Bodhisattvas, and it takes two of three major focuses to apply the two to aid the third focus. And the first four presentations of 2012 was a prelude to the year, and we'll take our time and thoroughly comb through something that is tremendously important to us. And that is, we are living in a new world. It is a new age. In 1946, there was held a series of conferences to assess what had happened with the use of the atomic bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And one of the most important persons there was a man, a very great man, at the time a professor at the University of Chicago. His name was Arthur Holly Compton, for whom the Compton satellite was named. And his brother Carl Compton was also in on a very small group of people who were planning, before the atomic bombs were tested early in 1945, about this time of year, the atomic bombs would be in July of 1945, and the use August 6th, 1945. Compton headed, Arthur Compton, headed the delegation of the scientists who were making the atomic bomb. And he was one of the few who was able to unite together the scientists from Oak Ridge, the scientists from Chicago, the scientists from Los Alamos, the scientists from Berkeley and from Caltech, to make an appeal on two points about atomic energy. The first point is that there was be no way to prevent other nations from following eventually and attaining atomic weapons. The second, that the nature of man was going to be different from all traditional assessments, and that one had to prepare for an international control of atomic energy, and one had to prepare a new calibration of education to prepare people to recognize that they are living in a world with more dimensions than had previously been available to man. These considerations were presented to FDR, Franklin D. Roosevelt, but unfortunately he died. And the Vice President, Harry S. Truman, came in to be the president. And it wasn't until 1946 that he finally acceded to developing the Atomic Energy Committee, the AEC. But he turned over control of how atomic energy would be assessed on the agenda of the AEC to the military. This caused an immense consternation. We live in a time when time forms are seen not just to repeat or to reoccur, but to spiral in intensity. And what this series, Hermetic Bodhisattvas, is about, is about 2,000 years ago, the shift of a new age happened. One of the great documents at that time was a book which is in the New Testament, the Epistle to the Hebrews. And we'll talk about that somewhat today. It begins this way. In many places and ways, God spoke in antiquity to the fathers through the prophets. In the last of these days, he has spoken to us through a son, whom he established heir to all, whom he also made the ages, meaning the time forms. The Greek word for the time form that he made was an aeon, and the plural is aeonos in Greek. It means that the energy of time is the first dimension of phenomenality, and it spontaneously occurs out of what the Greek term was eidos, which means eternal. So that time spontaneously was created out of eternity. And in doing so, it was created fertile so that it instantly, not spontaneously, but instantly, created the three dimensions of space. And once you had a fabric of space-time, phenomenality could occur in a symmetrical energy wave frequency and in particality that was integrated. So you had particles and waves. And the ancient way to express that was the waves and the particles. Time is the energy. It is the dark energy of string theory. Space is the dark matter. It is material, but it is not material that can be seen. But out of that combined fabric of space-time, light occurs to give a differentiation, balance, and symmetry to the integral of the four-dimensional space-time. And that light, as it occurs, occurs fertilely and creates out of the phenomenality the organic possibilities of life. And so the way that the Gospel of St. John begins, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was light, and the light was the life of men. The combination of the Epistle to the Hebrews and the Gospel of St. John is a very steep curve to a central realization that they are related in a quintessential way, and that the author of the Epistle to the Hebrews assumed in antiquity for a long time, for protective reasons, to preserve the manuscript, it was attributed to St. Paul, so that it would have been unthinkable in terms of the early church to weed it out of the New Testament as many volumes were weeded out. The Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, the parables from the book of Enoch, the odes to Solomon, which we will see are by Mary Magdalene, and many others were sifted out to keep a comprehensive doctrine matrix. So attributing the epistle to the Hebrews to Paul was very easy to do because tacked on to the end of the epistle to the Hebrews was a paragraph that included, give my regards also to Timothy, who was the right-hand man to Paul for the last bits of years that remained for him as a missionary. And Timothy's place was taken then by a doctor, by the man who became St. Luke, when he was arrested and kept in prison in Caesarea for a couple of years and then sent to Rome for trial and was kept there. Luke went with him to be a physician and also to write the gospel of Paul. And the gospel, of course, of Luke is in two parts. It's the gospel, according to Luke, and it's the book of Acts, which develops the way in which Paul was the logical vector of the New Testament, carrying it to a wider world, to the world of Gentiles. The fact is, Paul was a persecutor of Christians. He was the one that went and got men and women and children and dragged them back to Jerusalem to stand trial and be sentenced. He was on his way to Damascus when he was seized by a psychic whirlwind and became blinded and was blind for 3 days. He could hardly speak. And the phrase that echoed in his mind was, "Why are you persecuting my people?" He was so shaken that he went to his hometown, Tarsus, in what is today Turkey, Asia Minor, and spent 14 years in a nervous breakdown. After 14 years, the man in charge on Cyprus of the Christian nascent community, they weren't called Christians yet. They were called hearers of the way. The man's name was Barnabas. His father was named Nabas, so he was the son of Nabas, Bar-Nabas. And Barnabas was also the brother of Cleophas, who was the husband of one of the four sisters of Jesus. Her name was Mary. And they had a son who was named, with family names, was named John Mark. He became eventually St. Mark. So Barnabas was the uncle of St. Mark. When Paul was fetched by Barnabas, he was taken to Antioch to begin his rehabilitation as being a missionary to the Gentiles. And it took about a year. Now, he was fetched in 51 AD. He was arrested in 60 AD. So he only had 9 years of missionary work. And those 9 years did not begin until the 50s AD. Jesus was born in 9 BC and was almost immediately taken to Egypt. Taken not to the Egypt that the Coptic Church lists as its pilgrimage package for about 1,500 years. He was taken to Alexandria because his father Joseph was not just a carpenter, he was a master architect. He knew how to source the wood and the building materials. He knew how to get it shipped, and the Jewish shipping capital at the time was not Caesarea, but was ancient Tyre, the ancient Phoenician port. And the family that ran the shipping business out of Tyre to Alexandria and to the Aegean Islands was the family of Lazarus. His father's name was Simon. And when his father contracted leprosy, he became known as Simon the leper, the young son, Lazarus, had to take over, not only taking over the company, the shipping, which he was masterful at, but he also had to take over the responsibility for his younger sister. His older sister, Martha, relocated the family villa from Magdala on the Sea of Galilee to the hill known as the Mount of Olives, because the Mount of Olives at that time contained not only cemeteries, but contained also the Valley of the Lepers. And on the far side of the Mount of Olives, the big family home was established with Martha in charge, but young Mary Magdalene was put in charge of Lazarus in Tyre, and she was given one of the best educations in the world because the family was not only wealthy and well-connected, and the biggest connection that they had was between the Phoenician, ancient Phoenician coast and Alexandria as the world city. The most powerful family in Alexandria, outside of the Ptolemies themselves, were Jews who had been there from the founding of the city and were granted two very special qualities and privileges. The first is that they were able to take Alexander as their family name. And two, that the Jewish community in Alexandria would not be subject to the complete control of the Hellenistic Macedonian inheritors of Alexandria, but they would have an independence, a semi-independent community. And in Greek, the name for that community would be eventually not the polis, but the politeia, the subset of the city. In Jesus' time, the two most important human beings closest to him were Mary Magdalene and Philo of Alexandria, who was the one of two brothers currently at the time in the life of Jesus, who ran the tremendous trading in Alexandria using the equipment, the ships, the shipbuilding, and so forth, and some contacts in the Eastern Mediterranean, but their main wealth was because they controlled the shipping that went to the Far East, meaning India. So that the Alexander family, two generations before Philo, his grandfather aided Julius Caesar in the Alexandrian War and literally saved his life and literally saved his bacon. So they were awarded by Julius Caesar with the privilege of using his name as the middle name of all the sons from then on in the family, so that they were always something Julius Alexander, so that Philo's real name was Philo Julius Alexander. And he had two nephews. The older nephew was Marcus Julius Alexander, and he was put in charge of the family shipping business from Alexandria to all the ports in the east, which went down the Red Sea. And the Red Sea at that time was called the Euthyrian Sea. In Greek, Euthyrian is red. And there was a classic book written in the middle of the first century AD, The Periplus of the Euthyrian Sea, Travel and Trade in the Indian Ocean by a Merchant of the First Century. That's how Thomas got to India, through the Julius Alexander family shipping. It's important because Marcus Julius Alexander eventually married a very beautiful woman named Berenice, who was the daughter of Herod Agrippa, who was the grandson of Herod the Great, who was a generation after Aristobulus, Herod Aristobulus, and Herod Antipas. And it was the Alexander family in Alexandria that financed him, that saved him. He had been raised in Rome, as many of the so-called royal Jewish families, but those Jewish families that were raised in Rome were raised because they were only half Jewish. The other half of their heritage was Idumean, that is, from Idumea, which at that time was really not a part of Judea. It was down east of Beersheba, and it was on the trade route that came up from the Aqaba area, where Eilat is today, up through Timnah, which were the mines of Solomon, to points that if you went forward, you would go to the east of the Dead Sea. But there was a cutoff that went to the coast through Idumea. And so those generations, beginning with Herod the Great, about 38-39 BC, they had their sons raised in Rome so that they could be good contacts for the Romans to control the kingship of Palestine. That's how they got there. By an Alexandrian prince, Jewish prince, like Marcus Julius Alexander, marrying Berenice, it seemed to make it possible for the mother of Herod Agrippa, her name was Cypris, she was gorgeous, she was unbelievably beautiful, and so her daughter, of course, was one of the most beautiful women of the time. They were financed by Philo's brother, who was in charge of the financial details of the family. He is the one that had the sons. Philo was married, but they had no children. Someone once asked Philo's wife, why do you dress so and live so ordinarily when you have all of this wealth? And she said, I have an ornament of a husband. That's the kind of woman she was. When Marcus Julius Alexander died prematurely, his widow, Berenice, became the mistress of his brother's commanding officer, who was the son of the Roman emperor, Vespasian. His name was Titus. Titus Flavius, who, when his father died, became the Roman emperor. He could never marry Berenice because she was Jewish, but he loved her madly and so would not take other wives at all. But Titus was brilliant at two things, politics and military strategy. When he was young, he was assigned to become the procurator of Palestine, even though he was still very young. And he learned to understand that the Palestinian Jews were not worldwide like the Alexandrian Jews. Alexandria was from the beginning, like San Francisco, made to be a world city, was never a village. When Titus was a little older, he was made governor of Egypt. And when his father became enmeshed as the new Roman emperor, by the way, declared in Alexandria by the military and by the support of the Jews of Alexandria, which was a paradox because some of the Jews in Alexandria by that time, by 68 AD, had become followers of the way of Jesus and were not technically yet Christians, but they were no longer Hebrews as Jews. They were in a transition period. It's interesting to see the convolutions of the swirl of an end of an age and of the beginning of a new age, that always there's a double chiral swirl. There's one swirl by those in power from the past, from tradition, from possession, from authority, to maintain it and to stay with it. There is a growing, small, but growing quickly counter chirality, which is for the new, which is for a recalibration. And so these two swirls have a point where they're in a balance. And the balance usually comes about 75 years after the ushering in of a new age. It is a classic time form analytic. But the trigger usually comes about 22, 23 years after the new aeon occurs for it to absorb the spontaneous time energy from eternity to make it begin to have a special kind of light. That kind of a light. In Greek, the translation sometimes is for it to be a reflection, that it's a light that is strong enough to be reflected. But the Greek word is apangasma. Apangasma does not mean reflection, it means radiance. It means that the light is radiant. What is it radiant with? It's radiant with spontaneous eternity. And because it's radiant with spontaneous eternity, it can instantly, in the twinkle of an eye, change the dimensions of spatiality so that the space now is not just phenomenal, but is holy. It's a sacred space. And that the time form feeds the sacredness of that space from the spontaneousness of eternity coming into play, not just in the world, but in worlds without end. This is how that works. It is difficult because the usual translation of a Greek word in the New Testament, the word is pheron. Pheron is translated as sustaining because, yes, it seems to sustain, but the actual meaning of it is that it creates. It's creative. It's creative in the world because the time energy has made the space sacred with the way in which the eternal radiance is not only in the light, but the way in which the light is fertile for life. Key to the calibration of this spectrum is the language that is able to be, as I put it, differentially conscious. It is able to be written. It is able to be spoken. When you first begin to learn it, you have to learn it by hearing it because you can't read it yet. And so you have to have ears to hear before you would be able to read it, because the ears that can really hear have to listen. And the listening is a quality where the language orally has an acousmatic quality that, as Philo says in The Contemplative Life, one of his famous treatises, it seems that the mind in its membrane of its integral, of its wholeness, gets engraved on the inside of that membrane, that the hearing engraves the listening into the very structure of the mind at the point of its integral. And when it does, these engraving words in that sacred space, with the fertility of the new time form, with the spontaneous eternity coming into play, makes portals in the membrane that are just like the portals in a cell of living organisms. And those portals in living cells are the way in which nutrition and energy are passed through from cell to cell to cell to cell. That's how cells get nourished. That's how they communicate. Those are established so that the mind itself becomes fertile and nourishable. And when it does, that nourishment breathes a new quality of eternity and of sacredness through the apangasma radiance that allows for one to begin to understand that the mind now is transparent because it has all of these portals. The walledness of the old is perforated by the portals of the new, and one is able to hear newly. One is able then to read transparently. And so the meaning that would have been captured and kept in the brain is free to be in further dimensions of the real. This is how it works. It's very difficult to teach it until someone begins to understand, and cannot even begin to understand until they can listen, and cannot begin to listen unless they have this calling. And that calling occurs instantly and has to be accepted instantly on the basis of a spontaneity. The more that one dithers about it, the less instantly it is, the more opaque is the spontaneity, and doubt is the outcome of that. And so when they say faith, the faith is trust the spontaneous, it's eternal. Trust the instantaneous, because that's the time it is. And when you do, you will be fertile, and you will grow, and the apangasma will shine through you. Let's take a break. Let's come back to a focus. We are trying to learn how to learn. Something religious is binding. Religio means binding. We're trying to unbind. Something which is egotistical is framed and guarded from being entered. We're trying to perforate massively so that the winds of reality can blow clear through us. It's like when the chi is free in the body, you're healthy. If it's blocked up and you have to go for acupuncture or acupressure to free it up, to regain your health, the mind tends to clog very quickly. And it fudges because it tries to make up by controlling what we do. And the more that we try to control what we do, the more what we do has a false resonance, which entraps more. It's called karma. It's like a Chinese puzzle. The more you pull on it, the tighter it gets. If there is a release, the release has a two-step. It has an acceptance and it has an absorption. One is absorbed into the context. And the first context that is absorbed is the spatiality. The second that one is absorbed into is the freedom of time. And the thrice greatest is to be absorbed into eternity. So that Hermes Trismegistus, classically, is the mind shepherd, shepherding the mind so that it can be accepting enough to begin the absorptions. It's not about religion. The pneumatic is a spirit, and it is more real when it is elegantly wild. We're looking at the way in which two very close persons, classically in Alexandria to Jesus, left the next generation that they were preparing even more precision prismed than they were in order to be able to further the what a subtitle of a translation of the Upanishads by Aldous Huxley and Swami Prabhavananda and Christopher Isherwood was the breath of the eternal. When you have the breath of the eternal, now you have great breath. In Sanskrit, it's brihad. Now you can breathe. Philo prepared a man who became Apollos of Alexandria, who wrote the epistle to the Hebrews. Mary Magdalene prepared St. John to be St. John, young John, John Bar Zebedee, so that when they first met, they met like someone in the 8th century in China said, when two Zen masters meet, it's like two open doors. Reality breeze, unimpeded. That was in 57 AD in Ephesus, in Asia Minor. Very big urbane city at the time. From the port of Ephesus, one could look out on the Aegean, and off in the distance, where one could see some of the mountains of Samos, where Pythagoras was born and grew up. And if you looked the other way out in the distance, was the beginning mountains of the big island of Chios, where Homer was born and lived. But Ephesus was the sacred space of the feminine of the Greek goddess image of Artemis. And the temple of Artemis was the largest temple in the ancient world. It was almost 900 feet long, the size of a battleship. The sister of Apollo. It is amazing to realize that when Mary Magdalene was given the charge of young John, it was the last act of Jesus on the cross. Woman, behold your son. Man, behold your mother. It was the first spirit child of the new Anne. And he was raised by this brilliant woman, and next week we will see how incredibly brilliant she really was. And she was also given charge of Jesus' mother, Mary, and two of his brothers, Joseph and Simon, went with them. And also the disciple. And by the way, disciple is the wrong translation of the term. It actually means hearer, somebody who can hear, who can listen, who can be engraved by language that opens the channels of nutrition and life. The hearer, the disciple, was Nathanael, whose father was from Alexandria, named Ptolemy. And so he was referred to as Nathanael Bar Ptolemy. And Aramaic speakers couldn't pronounce Ptolemy, so it was Bar Ptolemy, which became corrupted and became Bartholomew in Greek, who brought his wife along, and also the Apostle Philip, who brought his wife and his three daughters, who were young then at that time. So there was a whole entourage that went to Ephesus, like there was a large entourage of the rest of the Holy Family that went to Glastonbury. But the emphasis is that Apollos and St. John met at what was the comesis of Mary Magdalene in 57 AD. She didn't die, she went to sleep. And she was placed in quite a large cave, and it is still to this day referred to as the Cave of the Seven Sleepers. And it's the only site of holiness that is common not only in the New Testament, but also in the Quran, Surah 33. Apollos came from Alexandria to deliver the epistle to the Hebrews to a population of people that had been missionized by Paul to such an extent that they were confused. And so the epistle to the Hebrews was to comb out the confusion. On the occasion of the comesis of Mary Magdalene, and her sarcophagus is still there. It's huge and massive. I will bring a photograph of it next week. It has the deep swirls of energy that show the incredible, not focus, but prismatic apangasma, the radiance of this kind of an energy. St. John went back to Alexandria with Apollos and was there until 68 AD. And that's when he wrote his gospel, which is a symmetrical parenthesis with the epistle to the Hebrews, having 11, 12 years in between. It's interesting because at that time, this younger nephew of Philo, not Marcus Julius Alexander, but the younger nephew was born about the same time that Tiberius Caesar ascended to the Roman emperorship because Augustus had died. After 44 years of ruling the world, he died. And when Tiberius was announced in Alexandria, was about the time that the younger nephew was born, and so his name was Tiberius Julius Alexander. And as I related earlier, he became the head of Palestine at a very young age, in his 20s. A little bit older, maybe in his early 30s, governor of Egypt, but he also was one of the great generals of all time, and he was the general with Titus, the son of the emperor Vespasian, who laid siege to Jerusalem and destroyed the temple. Now, it's peculiar and paradoxical in our time, because we don't recognize the aesthetic nor the analytic that is there by the dimensions of differential consciousness. And all of this is to reinstate the qualities of appreciation that there is a truth that can be known and it will make us free. It does that. Apollos and St. John in Alexandria prepared an immense community of followers of the way. They didn't call themselves Christians. They were not doctrinaire. Doctrinaireness would be an egotistical delusion. It makes everything else beside the point, and those who are doctrinaire develop what is called a subconscious, because they're not conscious, which is a differential radiance. it gets packed in and packed in so that they become hard little icy snowballs instead of a beautiful, gentle snowfall that makes some winter evenings blessed. If you've never been in a real quiet, heavy snowstorm with pink or orange lights, and the sky is lavender, and it is just a blessing. It is a universal quality of the purity of the sacred space of the earth at that moment. I'll bring a Japanese print next week of a lone figure trudging through a fresh snowfall under a starry night with the village huts quietly there, safe and ensconced. And it is the image of the founder of the Tiantai sect of the Mahayana, the Great Heaven Way. And when we get to looking at and combing out the bodhisattva resonances of the Hermetic, then we will begin to be able to appreciate and understand what a tremendous interweaving goes on. A preview: the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Thodol, is 49 days duration. And on the 50th day, on the Jubilee, is when the threshold either opens or closes, and you have to come back or you're free. All of this is Hellenistic Judaism in the way that traverses over a complete millennia before that even begins to surface. What's interesting is that Apollos and St. John together were so enormously capable in their synergy that the community that they developed was a community that would not respond to a doctrinaire approach like Paul or like Peter. And so when St. Mark left Rome in 65 AD, he didn't go to Alexandria. He went to where Peter had taken him in 44 AD, a big Roman fortress in the Nile River, and that fortress is still there. And because it was classically built long before the Romans, and not built by Egyptians, though it was for the Egyptians, the workmen and the architect were from the Middle East, from what is today Iraq. And they called the fortress Babylon. And so when you read the first letter of Peter in the New Testament, it's not from Babylon as some kind of saying that this is metaphorical. It was the name of the huge fortress. The fortress is almost a whole island, and it's large enough to have among many, many buildings, six churches. And one of the churches is the oldest church there, and it is called the Hanging Church because it was built in between two columns of the massive walls of Babylon, and it was slung between those two. And that hanging church is still there today. And in that church is still the podium that St. Mark used to preach, and the bench that he sat on to preach, and is still there today. He was there, paradoxically, like Paul, in a kind of a limbo exile. Paul after his blindness, St. Mark after the crucifixion of Peter. And after 14 years, When Apollos finally died in 80 AD, that's when St. Mark first went to Alexandria. And because he brought a Peter, Paul, Roman Christianity that didn't appeal right away at all to those who were in the way, in the great way. The skew is that when the Christian church began to solidify its authority, it said, and still maintains today, that St. Mark was the one who converted Apollos to Christianity. You can read it for yourself. It is doctrinal. All those religious churches are founded on a similar skew. Their time is over. Not because I say it. The time was up. That old aeon is gone. And the swirl, the double chiral swirl, as they say in the Quran, God favors the merciful. Here's how the Hermetica came to be, because after 10 years of this kind of interference by Roman power Christianity doctrine, the third generation from Philo and Mary Magdalene to Apollos and St. John came together and composed the Hermetica. And the first Hermetica is the Poimandres, the Shepherd of Minds. And it begins in this way. This is Walter Scott's translation. Once on a time, not once upon a time, which is mythic, once on a time form, when I had begun to think about the things that are, and my thoughts had soared high aloft, while my bodily sense had been put under restraint by sleep. Yet not such sleep as that of men weighed down by fullness of food or by bodily weariness. I thought there came to me a being of vast and boundless magnitude. Why is it boundless? Boundless magnitude. Because the time is filled with eternal dimensions. And so the space has that fertile unboundedness. The Greek term aeonios is not just a plural of aeon, but connotates what in English is, the word is everlastingness. It goes from aeon to aeon, but it goes from aeon to aeon in its everlastingness of development, of being able to bring more and more energy from the time form into the integral of the way in which the universe coming out of that time form works, but works in such a way that the wave energy of time and the particle integral are able to be transformed when there's a quintessential dimension of vision. And that vision, quintessentially fifth, the fifth business in theater is the magic. There are times in the theater where the audience and the actors interchange selves in such a way that the venue becomes transparently radiant. There was a great song in the 1940s. I remember as a 9-year-old. We danced around a maypole at the end of this evening ceremony, and all of the adults put their arms around each other, and the men and women sang together, "It's a grand night for singing. The stars are bright above, and I feel like, yes, I feel like falling in love." It is a interesting thing because it is the choir of men and women together for the first time that Philo writes about in On the Contemplative Life. And he has a very interesting thing that the prototype of it was that after the Exodus, after crossing the Red Sea that was parted, the community of those that had been delivered stood on the far shore of the Red Sea and sang a hymn of praise for their deliverance. Philo writes, "This wonderful sight and experience, an act transcending word and thought and hope, so filled with ecstasy both men and women that forming a single choir, they sang hymns of thanksgiving to God, their Savior. The men led by the prophet Moses and the women by the prophetess Miriam," his sister, Mary. "It is on this model, above all, that the choir of the therapeutai, of either sex, note in response to note, that is contrapuntually, and voice to voice, the treble of the women blending with the bass of the men, create a harmonious concert, music in the truest sense. Lovely are the thoughts, lovely the words, and worthy of reverence, the choristers, and the end and aim of thoughts, words, and choristers alike is piety. Thus they sing until dawn, and together salute the sunrise of a new day in a blessed space, breathable with the liberty and freedom of eternal life." It's interesting because the Poimandres and Philo have very few studies. This is one of the few. And it's very difficult to read because it's in Dutch. It was published in Amsterdam in 1935. And Klaas Stuhr was the author. And let's see if I can make a spontaneous, I don't speak or read Dutch, but he was an academic professor in Nijmegen, which is a Dutch city, famous from World War II. And it was delivered as a series of lectures in June of 1935. In between Philo and the Hermetica beginning is the development of Apollos, which is there in the Epistle to the Hebrews, but mentioned also in the book of Acts, mentioned also in Paul's first letter to Corinthians, and mentioned also in the letter of Titus, all in the New Testament. When we come to Mary Magdalene and we come to St. John next week, and the way in which their synergy led to the Hermetica as well, the Hermetica come out of a period from 57 AD to beginning about 90 AD. The first 11, 12 years when those two spirits, those men, were together in Alexandria, and then about a decade of their community that was quite healthful and quite large, enormous, as a matter of fact. The Apollos says, "There are so many who know this, that they are a cloud of witnesses. And Dorothy Sayers took that phrase as one of her great mysteries with Lord Peter Wimsey, cloud of witnesses. That it wasn't a small group anymore. It wasn't an esoteric group. It was a population of men and women. And one of the characteristics of it is that the men and women had a symmetry because they had a chirality that was differential as well as being able to function in an integral. And when that chirality and that symmetry are there, the light has a radiance to it. Later on, the emphasis of that in about 100 years would be that the light of life spiritually then has an emanation. And the great Hermetic teacher who developed that was Plotinus. And Plotinus lived from 204 to about 269, late 269, almost 270. He was almost 40 before he met the right teacher. And the right teacher was not some powerful, famous person, but was, his name was Ammonius Saccas. He was Ammonius the sack carrier. He was someone who literally worked on the docks in the 1960s. I knew such an individual as well. His name was Eric Hoffer. He was a longshoreman in San Francisco, and he was the greatest philosopher of that whole era. And you can look him up, and his first book is a classic called The True Believer. It came out in 1957. Came out almost the same time that Sputnik went up. And he says, the dangerous thing about a true believer is not that they will die for their cause. They will see to it that you die for their cause. He wore glasses. He's kind of a chunky, beefy guy. He wore plaid shirts and tough twill pants. Ham-like hands because of being a longshoreman. But the clarity and undulation of his ability to speak spontaneously, which is always a sign, it's always the ears go up. Here's someone who can speak clearly, seamlessly, almost indefinitely. And if one is able to listen to that in that way, there's an exchange where you are the teacher of yourself, and he is the listener through you to that teaching. And the same thing in the Hermetica, that one finds this. Philo also is careful to say, and to write this, they lay self-control to be, as it were, the foundation of their soul, and on it build other virtues. None of them would put food or drink to his lips before sunset, since they hold that philosophy finds its right place in the light, the needs of the body in the darkness, and therefore they assign the day to one and some small part of the night to the other. Some in whom the desire for studying wisdom is more deeply implanted, even only after 3 days, remember to take food. Others so luxuriate and delight in the banquet of truths, which wisdom richly and lavishly supplies, that they hold out for twice that time, and only after 6 days do they bring themselves to taste such sustenance as is absolutely necessary. They have become habituated to abstinence like the grasshoppers, who are said to live on air, because I suppose their singing makes their lack of food a light matter. But on the seventh day, they consider it to be sacred and festal in the highest degree, and have awarded special privileges as it is due. The allusion to the grasshoppers in the Greek, the species translates as cicadas. It's in Plato's dialogue, the Phaedo. Not the Phaedo, but the Phaedrus. And in the Phaedrus, Phaedrus and Socrates have gone outside of the city of Athens, outside of the bounds, where Socrates has lived and taught most of his life. And on the banks of this little stream, the Issus, under beautiful trees, which contain the cicadas that constantly sing. If you've never heard them, it is an interesting thing. It's like crickets raised to an nth degree. And the sound of them is not a cacophony, but it's like an infinite filigree of overlapping choruses and chorales, rondos. And listening to the cicadas, Socrates says, now we are in the company of those who only take moisture and nourishment once in 7 days. And so Philo here is saying, we're among those who live in this infinite overlay of sound that doesn't interfere with our hearing. The truth, which includes the silence in between the words as well. And it's through that in-between silence that the eternal is present when you breathe in, is present when you breathe out. And so that the cycle of breathing is a pair of pairs, two respiratory and two silent. So that when it speaks in that cadence, it is listenable to as deep as you can go, even to absorption in eternity. More next week.